So you might be wondering, what the hell are we doing tonight, based on the
manual?
And that would be a good question, because really you're not doing anything that's directly in the manual. The animal behavior chapter was important, but you're not going to be using any of those animals that were given as examples. You're going to be actually using no animals tonight, but you're going to be preparing, or you're going to be designing an experiment that you'll actually run next time, using the animals that are out, but they're just there this week just to look at. Those are bean beetles, so that's what you'll be using. But since we're talking about since we're dealing with the scientific method, I want to say some things about that, especially because I have a lot of students get this stuff wrong. Even though I'm sure you've learned this stuff before, it just doesn't sink into a lot of students' brains, seemingly, at least not permanently. So let's talk about the scientific method. One thing that probably about half students get wrong, if I ask them, is what is the difference between a hypothesis and a prediction. People mix these two up all the time. So let's drive this home. What is a hypothesis? It's not a question. It's linguistically or based on language, it's actually the opposite of a question. It is an answer in a sense. A hypothesis is an explanation. An explanation of something that you're wondering about based on some observation you made in the universe. All right? So we as curious animals notice things about the universe. We say, why is that? And then we formulate hypotheses, one or more hypotheses, but each hypothesis is an explanation of why things are the way they are. And a hypothesis, the reason I said it's the opposite of a question, is because it's stated in such a way as to say that it's true, whether it is or not. A hypothesis is stated as though it's true, and it's therefore a declarative statement. And not all hypotheses are formatted the same way, but one way to format a hypothesis and just know from sentence structure that it's a hypothesis is that you would say, observation, whatever that is, the sun is shining, whatever your observation is, because, and then after that because is the explanation, right? That's a hypothesis. And it pretends to be correct. You assume that it's correct when you state it, even though it might not be correct at all. But a hypothesis naturally leads to a prediction. In other words, the logic is that if you assume the hypothesis, whatever it is true, then you would expect something to happen if you were to test that hypothesis, right? Whatever will happen, and notice the future tense of will, is a prediction. So you can tell just linguistically that a statement is either predictive or descriptive or explanatory, right? That's the main difference between hypothesis and prediction. So, you know, an example of a hypothesis is birds fly because they are lighter than air. Right? Birds fly is the observation you've made. And the part that's after the because explains why that's true. Right? So, and it's stated in such a way as to be true. Actually isn't true, of course. That's not why birds fly, but that's one hypothesis. And hypotheses don't have to be true. this is really the essence of science. We don't just come up with explanations and say, okay, this is the truth, believe me. That's not science. Instead, we have to test that hypothesis, right? And so that's why hypotheses, after they lead naturally and logically to predictions, you go the next step and actually test that prediction. You test the hypothesis by doing an experiment that will test whether that prediction comes true or not. And the logic is, if the hypothesis is true, then the corresponding prediction should come true if you run the appropriate test. All right? So, for instance, an easy to understand, very simple observation is that a flashlight does not work all of a sudden. It used to work, now it doesn't. That's an observation you make. There's all kinds of hypotheses you could come up with to explain that, but two straightforward ones are the flashlight doesn't work because the cells are dead. Cell or cells, however many it uses. The batteries, in other words. Right? That's one hypothesis. Another is the flashlight doesn't work because the bulb is burned out. And see how each of those naturally leads to its own prediction, right? The prediction for the cells being dead is if, and that's another key word in a prediction, if I replace the cells with fresh cells, the flashlight should work again. That's a prediction. Or it will work again, right? And the corresponding prediction for the other hypothesis is if I replace the bulb with a new bulb, the flashlight will work again. Another prediction that corresponds to the other hypothesis. Predictions then naturally suggest a way to test it. You actually go through with something that will test whether the prediction comes true or not, right? So if you're going with the cells hypothesis, dead cells hypothesis, then the test is actually to do that, right? To replace the cells. Put in a fresh battery, and you get a result. All right, now what would happen? I mean, if I actually do that, I'm going with the dead cells hypothesis. I think it might be true, so I'm going to test that. I've replaced the cells. They're definitely brand new cells. What happens? What can I say if the flashlight lights up? What does that tell me scientifically? That the hypothesis is supported in that case. But importantly, it doesn't mean that the hypothesis is true. Right? Supported means that the hypothesis could be true. That's what a prediction coming true tells you about the hypothesis. Importantly, it does not prove the hypothesis because it might be actually that the problem was a loose wire that I jiggled just the right way when I replaced perfectly good cells with other perfectly good cells, and I just happened to put the wire in the right position so that now it had electrical continuity again and it lights up. But it was never the problem that the battery was dead, right? So a positive result does not prove that the hypothesis is right. It supports it, though. And if you keep testing a hypothesis, different people test it, you test it over and over, test it in different ways, if the predictions continue to come true, then you're lending more and more support to that hypothesis. Eventually, we call these things facts. But really, scientifically, we can't ever absolutely prove anything. The things that we say are true happen to just be the things that continue to stand up to testing. Like gravity, for instance, a fact. Even though it's called the theory of gravity. Theory in science doesn't mean doubtful. Theory is a compliment in science. It means beyond a hypothesis. It's never failed, basically. Another example is evolution. Fact. Because it continuously stands up to testing. All right? But that doesn't mean that it's definitely true, because every once in a while we test things in a certain way or think about it differently and realize what we've said is the truth hasn't been at least completely true. For instance, Newtonian mechanics, classical physics, right? That describes well how the macroscopic world works. So we still learn, teach, and use Newtonian mechanics, but that really isn't how the laws that are obeyed. And so eventually we replaced that with quantum mechanics, which is true in the macroscopic and the microscopic reality. It's just that Newtonian physics comes very close, right? So we have new truths all the time, depending on science. Now, on the other hand, if the prediction does not come true, if the light does not work, then I can say that I've disproved the hypothesis. So we can scientifically disprove things, we just can't prove them absolutely. We can only support hypotheses. All right, does that make logical sense? Okay, good. Now to the next thing. In any given scientific experiment, there are, generally speaking, three kinds or categories of variables. What are those three types of variables? Yeah.
Independent, dependent, control.
Exactly. Independent variable, dependent variable, controlled variable. Those are three categories. First of all, just at the most basic, a variable, of course, is just anything that can vary. And there's really no end to the list of things in the universe that can vary. But when you're doing an experiment, you're trying to control the universe as much as you can so that only the thing you're interested in can be tested directly and not be affected by the rest of the universe, in a sense. So there's all kinds of variables that, if you didn't take steps otherwise, would vary. You try to actually make them not vary so that they won't affect your experiment, and that's why they're called controlled variables. A simple example of this is if I were to test whether the concentration of a fertilizer solution affects the growth rate of a plant. Okay, that's what I want to test. To set up my experiment, I would want to control all the kinds of variables I can that could affect growth. I don't want those things to have their effect. So first of all, I wouldn't just use one plant, right? I would use several plants so that I have robust statistics. But I wouldn't use several different types of plants. One controlled variable would be the species. I would use the same species. I would have them all be the same size to begin with, put them in identical pots, same soil, same amount of water, same amount of sunlight, and so on. All those things are controlled variables because I don't want them to affect my experiment. That brings up the other two, which is another thing that many students get wrong. The difference between the independent variable and the dependent variable. You can define these things a lot of different ways, but I think the best way of thinking about it and the best way of memorizing it once and for all is to think about it practically, meaning based on what you actually do in an experiment. So the independent variable is always the thing that you as the experimenter adjust or manipulate. Right? Whereas the dependent variable is always the thing that you as the experimenter measure in response. Okay? In my plant example, what's the independent variable? That doesn't go quite enough. Concentration of fertilizer. Because I wouldn't want to use different kinds of fertilizers, right? That would be a variable that I want to control. So yes, it would be the concentration of fertilizer, but it would be the same exact kind of fertilizer in every pot. That's my independent variable. That's what I'm manipulating. What's the dependent variable in that example? Growth rate of the plants, right. Which I could measure any of all kinds of ways, right? Millimeters per week or whatever. All right, those are the three classes of variables. Which one of those three classes of variables has no business being on a scientific graph? Which one? The controlled variables, yes. They're really, in a sense, not part of the experiment. So in a standard two-dimensional plot of data, a proper scientific graph, in other words, you have a vertical axis, the y-axis, a horizontal axis, the x-axis, and which variable belongs on the x-axis? It's the independent variable, always on the x-axis. Now, of course, you wouldn't label it as independent variable. You would put what it actually is. And the dependent variable is on the y-axis. So if you think about this in mathematical terms, in function terms, a mathematical function is a black box, basically, right? You put something into it, x. It does something to that x and pops out y. Well, that's what's happening in here. Whatever you manipulate is your input. That's your independent variable. And you measure the output based on what that input is. Okay? If you use, you don't have to, but often the word versus is used to describe a graph. Something versus something else. The only way to properly use that word in that case is if it's dependent variable versus independent. It's always y versus x, never x versus y. So in my plant experiment, it's what versus what? This is the same question, just asked a different way. What am I plotting? But what versus what? Growth rate versus concentration of fertilizer. Exactly right. Those are my two variables. We just said that a moment ago, right? So if I were to do that, I would get some sort of set of data points, right? It might go upward, it might go downward, or it could be a graph that looks like this. Now, if it is a linear relationship, they're not going to be perfectly collinear. But if they look like they more or less fall on the same line, then I can fit a line to them. And in this small example, the line I'm fitting would be horizontal, right? What does a horizontal line of best fit tell me about those data? Well, what's the mathematical equation for any given line? I'm sure you've had a math class.
Mx plus b.
Y equals mx plus b, yes. What is m?
Slope.
The slope. What is b?
Y-intercept.
The y-intercept, the point where the line crosses the y-axis. So, for a horizontal line, what is M? Zero. It has zero slope. What does that tell you, though, about the experiment or about that set of data?
Well,
Yes, because it's a zero slope, it doesn't matter what the x value is, right? You always get the same y value. But in this specific example, what that means is that the growth rate is always the same, regardless of concentration of fertilizer, right? In other words, even though we properly call growth rate, since that's the thing we're measuring, the dependent variable, in the case of a horizontal line of best fit, it actually doesn't depend on the independent variable. That's what you've shown. Okay? So that shows that there's independence of these two variables, which is itself a useful finding. Don't think that you have to get a positive result for a scientific experiment. You don't. Negative results give you useful information as well. But if it is a linear relationship and the slope is anything but zero, then it shows you that there is dependence of growth rate on fertilizer concentration, right? And it could be a positive slope or a negative slope. A negative slope would mean that giving it a higher concentration actually slows it down in growth rate. Okay. Those are the basics I wanted to get past you. Now, what you're actually supposed to be doing tonight, according to the syllabus, is library research, right? So, for the remainder, after I shut up, you should, first of all, work as groups. No group should have more than four. And if possible, no group should have fewer than two. So make yourselves into groups, whether it's how you're sitting now or not, I don't care. But anyway, talk about this thing as a group. What you need to do is, first of all, do a little bit of research about the animals you're going to be using, because probably no one here is a bean beetle expert yet. And so that's why you have the laptops out. You can research any way you want, but I really recommend starting by visiting a website whose URL is beanbeetle.org. Go to that first and learn a little bit about these creatures so that you can discuss what you might want to test in an experiment next week. But you have to work within the constraints. So you have to set up, start, and end the experiment all next week. It can't be something that is ongoing. You have to get your results same day that you set it up. So think about that when you can't do anything requiring more time or ridiculously elaborate. So you have basic stuff to work with. But based on, read about their life history characteristics, how they live, and also think about what you read about in the animal behavior chapter, and try to come up with a basic experiment. Just run it by me before you leave to make sure we could do that. I might have you amend it a little bit. And then next week we'll actually do it. All right?